KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, Bay Area poet Matthew Zapruder hears all too often from people that they simply don't get or like poetry.
And it makes me sad when I hear that, because I feel like it's like saying, oh, I don't like music, or I don't like food.
In his new book, Why Poetry?, Zapruder makes a case for the necessity of poetry in our lives. He explains how poetry can produce discoveries, connections, and glimmers of expression. He'll join us to share his thoughts on how to make poetry more accessible and more enjoyable. And that's next, right after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Former New York Times Magazine poetry editor Matthew Zapruder thinks that far too often schools teach students to overanalyze and agonize over the meaning of poetry, causing them to be wary of it. In Why Poetry, he lays out what he thinks is a better way to approach, to focus on the literal meaning and visceral experience of the words. And he joins us in studio this hour to discuss his book, his own verse, and how poetry makes sense of the human experience and condition and actually restores our humanity. And welcome to Matthew Zapruder.
Thanks, Michael. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. And this is something that's been on my mind for many years, how students think poetry is it's too symbolic, it's too impenetrable, it's too obscure, it's some kind of code that we have to learn, and we have to find the meaning and put the puzzle together. And as I said in the introduction, for you it's more look at the words and take them literally and look at the effect it has on you.
Mm-hmm. It seems so self-evident once you say it, but you should start by just looking at what the poet actually put down on the page. Poets are very careful with language and thoughtful about it, and everything has a reason for being there. And if you jump away from the literal meaning before even spending some time with it, you're going to be lost.
But you hear this argument. It goes back to Brooks and Warren and that kind of approach to poetry that you hear this argument that there's a poetic language, there's a figurative language, and it's a different language than you read in science books or even in short stories or novels.
Well, I mean, not to be dense, but it is actually the same language. It's the same words. It's the exact, and they have the same meanings. What the use they're put to is different in poems often, but you can't get to that use or those uses without really, again, just being very literal with the words on the page first. And once that happens and you do that, then all other sorts of figurative and symbolic meanings can open up later.
And you don't have to say this is the theme and the meaning of the poem. You have to talk more about how this poem draws you in. I remember a poem of Ishmael Reed's where he's talking about drawing you in and just keeping you there as a prisoner for a long time and making you disappear.
Right. It's an experience. I mean, reading a poem is an experience like any other form of art. It's not poems are not these meaning containers. And usually when people try to boil down the meaning of a poem to a single message or something, it's often quite banal. Death is scary. Life is sad.
Well, you know, I've had a little pet theory for a while that a lot of things went in a very different direction because of modernism and because of T.S. Eliot and a poem called The Wasteland, which had an enormous effect on poetry. And I say that because, you know, there's so many footnotes in The Wasteland and it seems so obscure on the face of it. But Eliot, terrible anti-Semite that he was, notwithstanding, Eliot had things to say about the wasteland, how it should affect us. He said, everybody knows what it is to feel that sense of lack of fulfillment or emptiness within, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that's at the heart of my poem. And that is at the heart of the poem.
Yeah, the modernism and the wasteland in particular is a complicated issue. You were in good company because William Carlos Williams agreed with you. He said that the wasteland gave poetry back to the academics and it was going to set American poetry back by decades. So he agreed with you. I think that it's complicated because the modernists believed that culture was disappearing and they thought that part of their role as artists was to kind of build almost like these time capsules that would contain all this knowledge that would survive. And so they believed that their poems should be full of allusions to mythological and historical and cultural.
Well, don't misunderstand me. I don't have anything against modernism or, literary history being embedded in poetry. I thought that was a fine idea, but I thought that led to a greater sense of, I suppose you could call it obscurity.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, it's a complex issue, but I mean, in the book, I take on the wasteland directly, or not take it on. I mean, I look at it, what it says. And again, I just make the argument that actually it's written in quite simple language, most of it. And if you just read it, you can get so much out of it. Then, of course, later on, there are many, many other things to explore about its symbolic and historical resonances and all that. But the beginning of the poem is, April is the cruelest month. And that's really very simple. that's not, you don't need a degree in you know, classical languages to understand that.
But you do understand it in terms of mythology. April's supposed to be when things are blooming and whatnot. Why is it the cruelest month? And because it's a poem about the war. But
right. But he says in the poem the reason it's the cruelest month is because it has to do with the land regenerating itself and how kind of there's an emotional resonance to what he's saying. Actually, I think. And then, of course, as you said, that about the war and other things are there too, for sure. But the first thing you can't. You need to have that first before you go.
I remember as a young man going to hear John Chardy, who was poetry editor of the Saturday Review for many years and translator of Dante, a real Renaissance man, say we shouldn't think about what a poem means. We should think how a poem means.
Yeah, he has a great essay with that title. I think it's how should a poem mean or how can a poem mean. I can't remember right now, but it's a lucid and really, really wise exploration of the same topic. And part of what happened when I was writing this book is as I went back and looked at a lot of writing about poetry, I realized that people had said, many, many people had said some version of what I was saying in all sorts of different ways before. And it seems to maybe just need to be reset every decade or so.
We're talking about poetry with Matthew Zapruder. He's a poet and author of Why Poetry. He's also associate professor at St. Mary's College of California and English professor, though you began as kind of a Russian lit guy at Berkeley and Slavic languages.
I did, yeah. I studied Russian literature in college, and then I lived in what was then the Soviet Union for a year, studying at Moscow State University, studying in quotes, I would say. And then I came back and eventually ended up going to Cal for, I was going to get my PhD in Slavic languages and literatures. And when I was there, I actually met Bob Haas. He doesn't remember it, but I remember it well. And I was already getting interested in poems, and then yeah, I just decided I needed to go be a poet. I couldn't be a scholar. It wasn't for me.
I think it's a great breeding ground here for poets. We got a couple of poet laureates, Bob Haas and Kay Ryan. And I think even Robert Pinsky was here at Berkeley when he was named poet laureate for the first time. But getting back to what a poem means or how a poem means, you talk about Paul Valery as saying a poem is really a kind of machine for producing the poetic state of mind by means of words.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty good definition, but it gets you into discussing how poems really should be creating more of a kind of dream effect or consciousness change or something along those lines. Yeah, even though you use the word machine, or he used the word machine.
Yeah, yeah, it's startling that he uses that sort of a non-organic metaphor for a poem, but it really made an impact on me when I read that. It sounded right to me. Yeah, I think that when you get into a poem or when a poem kind of catches you, it puts you in this different state of mind that just isn't, that no other forms of writing really do. And that may be one of its great, great purposes, poetry's great purposes to do that.
Well, and yet, what about meaning in a poem? For example, one of the most beautiful poems written by an American poet, and this gets us also in another question that I want to bring up with you, how political or how much meaning should poems have, particularly didacticism in poetry. But one of the great poems in the American canon is Wallace Stevens' Sunday Morning, which is really a philosophical discourse about death having its tie to beauty. And yet the poetry is sensuous. It's gorgeous, really. And very harmonious to hear as well. But this is a poem that emphasizes the aesthetic. And then you have all these poems, and you mentioned Audre Lorde, for example, and other poets who we identify more with. Adrian Rich later on, I think maybe it turned her against the kind of quality of her earlier poetry, wanting to be political in her poetry. So there is that division, and that division continues to exist. How does it work for you?
The urge to communicate is inextricably bound up in the use of language. Again, that's so obvious as to almost not be worth saying, but it's true. So anytime you use words, anytime you use language, it's you're making meaning. And the meaning-making aspect of language is such an intimate part of making poems. So it's part of the creation of that dreamlike state. It's not that they're not in opposition. It's not either you can have the dreamlike drifting, different consciousness of poetry, or things can mean things. They go together in this way that people who know poems know how that works.
But that's where you get into that whole sense of how much meaning ought to be emphasized in the poem. Like Sunday Morning, as I said, it's a century, it even comes out of a dream, a woman's dream, and also so forth. But it's really a poem of beauty and sensuousness, and yet very strong philosophical position.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing about Sunday Morning that's great is that it's really a poem that begins, a woman decides to stay home and lounge around in her lovely sounding sitting room. complacencies of the peignoir, and instead of going to church. And so she's having a kind of alternate religious experience in a way, and that's what launches the poem. And yeah, so meaning and what things mean is, and I think that sometimes when I talk about poems creating this dreamlike state, people get mixed up. They think I mean that poems shouldn't mean anything. And I certainly don't believe that either in my writing about poetry or in my own poems.
I'm reminded, and it's a poem I rather favor, of a poem by Marianne Moore called Poetry, where she begins by saying, I too dislike it, you know. But then she goes on to talk about imaginary gardens with real toads in them. And that's really a wonderful central metaphor, isn't it?
Oh, it's fabulous. I mean, you've hit on one of the other best definitions of poetry I've ever read, imaginary gardens with real toads in them. That poem, of course, as you know, is funny because she shortened it over the course of her life. It used to be much longer until in the final version it was just called Poetry, and the only words in it were, I too dislike it. But I prefer the longer version. I think she has a lot of good things to say in it.
How important is rhyme and cadence and prosody and all of those kinds of things?
I think I love poems that rhyme, actually. I love Kay Ryan, for instance, but I love rhyming poetry. I mean, Keats is one of my favorite poets.
My too.
And I personally am not drawn to rhyme in my own work. And I think of rhyme as being a sort of subset of what poems can do. It's a kind of way of putting things together that you might not think to put together otherwise. That's what a great rhyme is. It's like a great metaphor. It seems unexpected, and then after it happens, it seems inevitable. That's what the great rhymes do. But I think that all poetry does that. It's just that rhyme is a sort of subset of a way of doing that. That's a beautiful, you know, terrific subset. But it's also, I think, people have this anachronistic idea that, you know, in the olden days, all poems rhymed. But in fact, that's not true. Rhyme has gone in and out of style over the history of English language poetry.
How valuable do you think it is to have students memorize poetry, particularly younger students?
You know, I have mixed feelings about that. I think it's a wonderful thing to do. And I took a class with Joseph Brodsky, the Nobel laureate, when I was in college. He was teaching at Mount Holyoke, and I was at Amherst, and I used to come over once a week. And he used to smoke in class. It was great. And then we started smoking in class. It was pretty fabulous. But anyway, he made us memorize a poem each week. And it was, for me, it was really hard, but I got a lot out of it. On the other hand, though, poetry is so bound up with a lot of negative feelings for students that I sort of hate to load on an additional, you know, burden of that kind. So I really do have mixed feelings about it. But in the end, I think it'd be great if people memorized more poetry. Yes.
There's a lot of bad poetry. There's a volume called The Stuffed Owl. Are you familiar with it?
It's just a
volume of terrible and bad poetry. But then, you know, some people will say, I mentioned Sunday Morning by Wallace Stevens. A student would say, I don't understand that poem, but I understand Rod McEwen, you know, or a poet that you don't necessarily think of as being a good poet, you know, falls into kind of silly or solipsistic or sentimental doggerel or whatever it is. And the reality is that, you know, some students, for example, can get poetry at that level. And so they say, isn't that more important that I get the meaning out of this poem, but I don't get the meaning out of The Wasteland or Sunday Morning?
Yeah, it's been my experience that it's more effective to just show people other things that they might also like and not argue with them about what they do like. I mean, I might personally have my feelings of you know, repressed scorn at certain people's tastes, but and also I've been wrong, too, about certain things. I mean, I think when I was a younger poet, I might have turned up my nose at someone like Bukowski, for instance.
And how does it offend you should be labeled elitist, but yet, you know, in many respects, that comes out of diligent reading of poetry.
But I was going to say that it turns out that Bukowski's actually a fascinating poet, and I think I had just been generalizing about him and not really reading it. So you know, I can be wrong. I mean, you know, it's interesting sometimes to consider whether my own prejudices about art might be wrong, too, and to try to get into something that that the kids are reading nowadays.
Well, it could be prejudice against Bukowski because he was always acting out, you know, and doing things that were, by some standards, so to say, unseemly, to put it mildly. But that brings in a whole question of, you know, the poets as performers. I mean, some people read their poetry and it's dull, and it's actually wonderful poetry, but their reading it makes it dull. And then you have poets, a lot of these young rappers and everything, who give it all kinds of vitality and so forth, and it's not necessarily great poetry. But I'm thinking about particularly Dylan Thomas in this vein, you know, who lived out a life that really was like Hemingway in some ways. You know, he lived out a life that was an attempt to encapsulate his poetry.
I'll never forget, I heard a recording of Dylan Thomas one time when I was a young poet, and I remember him saying, "The synagogue of the ear of corn." And I just thought, wow, I want to do that.
That Welsh accent, boy, it really can. Richard Burton, right?
Yeah, I mean, poets, you know, they have this legendary kind of tendency to misbehave. And, of course, there are some notable examples. But a lot of the poets I know are, you know, when it's time to grind it out and get down to work, they have to stay focused. You know?
Well, when you started reading John Ashbery, who I think is a wonderful poet, you thought, this guy's a fraud, right? He's a hoax.
Yeah, and of course, you know, like so often in my life, I was totally wrong. I think I was bumping up against something new for me that was really attracting me, but also really hard for me to, you know, I needed to change in order to be able to read it. And it was tough to really get my head around it. But then I just stuck with it and kept reading and tried to relax into it. And then eventually I just let go of some ideas I have about poetry. And I was able to just fall into his amazing world. I mean, his gorgeous, strange, completely idiosyncratic use of language that's, I find, to this day, you know, mesmerizing and healing in a way, too.
Our guest is Matthew Zapruder, a poet, author of Why Poetry, associate professor at St. Mary's College in California, I was reminded of a line of Woody Allen's where he said, you know, we tend to, I'm paraphrasing here, we tend to evaluate poetry on how obscure it is. The more obscure, the more valuable it is. But in many young people's minds, that seems to be true when they take poetry courses and they're looking for symbols, like, you know, hunting for them and so forth.
Symbol hunting.
Symbol hunting, yeah. But you think that's not necessarily a bad thing, huh?
Well, I don't think that's the best way to start reading a poem. I think there are, in the book, I talk about symbols, a different sort of way of thinking about symbols, which is this way that a certain simple word can suddenly seem to be overflowing with meaning and signify all these things that go beyond its you know, it's just strictly functional use, and that poems in a way are there to enact that. But there's a difference between symbols and codes, or symbols and, you know, this kind of specific coded language. And I think that's a confusion sometimes that people have when they're reading poems.
Plus, they're also looking sometimes for one thing, monolithic with a symbol, as opposed to all radiating outward.
Right. I mean, in the book, I try to make a distinction between the use when we call something a symbol like a stop sign, or you know, which is a universally understood symbol for stopping, or a dove, which symbolizes peace, and that sort of functional symbols that we need sometimes to communicate, versus the poetic symbol, which doesn't have a single meaning like that. That's just not how it works. And if you read enough poems, I mean, you know, you start to understand that that's the case. But I think, you know, high school teachers, they're in a tough spot. They have to do a lot of things, and a lot of them aren't trained in poetry, and they have to teach these tests and all kinds of stuff, and the easiest way sometimes to teach poems is if they have single meanings that you're supposed to decipher, and that they're written like codes. And that's, I don't blame people for teaching that way, but I think it's a mistake, and I think it's damaging to poetry.
So what poets do you identify with? You mentioned Ashbery. Who else?
Well, I studied with the late, great American poet James Tate, he was my teacher and then later my friend. We mentioned Keats earlier. I've always been in love with Keats. I mean, he was one of the first poets I ever loved. I'm a big fan of Frank O'Hara. I have his Lunch Poems right here, actually. City Lights Publishing. Elizabeth Bishop was one of my early loves. And
boy, she's high on the stock exchange now.
Is she? Yeah. She's, they go up, they go down. And Lowell's down and Bishop is up, but it'll come around. And also Dickinson was a big person for me, because, you know, I went to college in Amherst and then grad school back there, and I I often, you know, I read everything, every letter, every poem, and she's a big one for me.
I have a friend and a former colleague named Maurice Basson who said, all you need to learn about life you can find in Emily Dickinson.
It's true. She's, and her, you know, we have this idea that she was this recluse who didn't know anything except, you know, the Common Book of Prayer and, you know, maybe the Bible, but actually she was so widely read and educated, and she knows a ton about science and mathematics. And
well, there's a new film with the woman from Sex and the City, in fact. I don't know if you saw it, where they try to give you a more multidimensional view of Dickinson. I haven't seen it either, but I've read good things about it.
But I think if you just read her, I mean, if one were to read her letters and her poems, you'd see that she's a woman of enormous erudition.
And we'd continue to sort of grapple with this whole idea of gender and poetry and women poets as opposed to male poets and so forth. But how do you feel about those lines? Have they become maybe a little bit too divisible?
I think that for a long time, American poetry was way too white and way too male. And in terms of what was read and what was taught and who was winning awards. And I think a lot of us took it for granted. Even when I was in school, that was mostly what I read. And I think that's been changing. And it's really been good because there are some great poets. I mean, poets like, for instance, I mean, I knew a little bit about Gwendolyn Brooks.
She's a great poet.
She is a fabulous poet. Yeah. And there's a new biography of her that just came out. A surprise.
She did get recognition, though. She won a Pulitzer Prize.
Oh yeah, but that's what's so interesting is that when I was in school, I barely studied her. I mean, maybe We Real Cool I had read, you know. But that was it. But she is an enormous poet, and she's someone like Audre Lorde, who I've gotten to know over the past few years. I mean, her poems, and. Or Etheridge Knight, or people, you know, people who are these brilliant poets who maybe read one poem in an anthology or something, but they're, and younger poets, of course. I mean, the world has gotten so much more interesting, and I'm fully into it. And
I'm glad you mentioned Etheridge Knight, because he sort of opened up a world of African-American lives in penitentiaries and prisons and so forth that was really, even before Eldridge Cleaver and people like that, you know, it really was something, a world that most people didn't know. And
Knight is a tremendous poet.
Well, I'm going to put a question out to our listeners. We're going to hear more about your poetry and maybe hear you read some poems in the course of the hour. But tell us about a poem you love and why it has meaning for you. And maybe you also may want to say something about how you approach reading poetry, or also invite listeners to let us know about the difficulties or obstacles they faced in reading poetry or being taught poetry. Let me give you the phone number to join us with Matthew Zapruder. Our toll-free number is, by the way, they often say your name with the Kennedy film, I'll bet, don't they?
They do.
Zapruder. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and we welcome your calls and your thoughts about poetry and why poetry can enhance life. Shelley called the poets the unacknowledged legislators of mankind, and indeed I like to agree with that wisdom. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum. Just simply click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum, and you can also, of course, put any questions or comments you might have or responses about letting us know what poems have made a difference in your life, have meaning to you, or have certainly had meaning in an important sense, and how you approach reading poetry. Let's get involved with you, our listeners, and you can also go to our Facebook page. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Matthew Zapruder, who is the author of a book called Why Poetry, and he's also a poet, and I'm looking at a comment here from a listener. It says, poetry with painting can be very powerful. Rapid Transit is a poem with a mural that I passed frequently as a grade school student in Chicago's Hyde Park. Together, they captured the turbulence and people power of the early 70s, and I'm glad that while many Chicago murals of that time have been painted over, that one was restored. And talking about painting and poetry, you know, there used to be an old cliche about people who... You say, how did you make it to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. Well, Matthew made it to Carnegie Hall, in a manner of speaking, because your poems have actually been put to music, yeah?
Right. Twice, actually, in Carnegie Hall. Once by the young composer Gabriel Kahane, whose father is also a well-known classical musician up here in this area. And then the next year by Missy Mazzoli, who used the text for my poems. And I wrote her some new text to make an opera called Vespers for a New Dark Age, which is an amazing performance. And Yeah, so it was pretty cool to go to Carnegie Hall and hear, odd experience to hear my things that I had written kind of come out of these beautiful
songs. Must have been divine. And on that note, we're going to hear some of your poetry. Can you read a couple from your collection?
Yeah, I'll read one from this book, Come On All You Ghosts, which is a book that came out in 2010.
And listen viscerally and listen literally.
Yes, I mean every word I say, I promise. So the poem, this poem is called April Snow, and it's an airport poem. I spend a lot of time in airports, and this one takes place in the El Paso airport.
I hope April is the coolest month.
It is. I guess I maybe subconsciously was thinking about the wasteland. April Snow. Today in El Paso, all the planes are asleep on the runway. The world is in a delay. All the political consultants drinking whiskey keep their heads down, lifting them only to look at the beautiful scarred waitress who wears typewriter keys as a necklace. They jingle when she brings them drinks. Outside the giant plate glass windows, the planes are completely covered in snow. It piles up on the wings. I feel like a mountain of cell phone chargers. Each of the various faiths of our various fathers keeps us only partly protected. I don't want to talk on the phone to an angel. At night, before I go to sleep, I'm already dreaming of coffee, of ancient generals, of the faces of statues, each of which has the eternal expression of one of my feelings. I examine my feelings without feeling anything. I ride my blue bike on the edge of the desert. I am president of this glass of water.
It's a lovely poem.
Thanks.
And the images are sharp and trenchant, I would say. And of course, I respond almost in an automatic Pavlovian way, thinking, let's take these images apart, you know, deconstruct them and so forth. And because the images are thinking about a mountain of cell phone chargers.
But I think, you know, it's like, I mean, not to keep saying the same thing again and again, but I think it's okay to go. I mean, I think a person who reads poetry a lot does this instinctively. They just read literally first and then they go to the next place. The problem is people who don't read it a lot or who are newer to reading it need to be sort of taught to do that. And so, you know, of course, all those other things can be there and we can take apart all the images and think about what they mean and maybe even just what they suggest to us personally that aren't even in the poem. That's a great conversation to have, too. I mean,
You're saying let the poem wash over you, really, aren't you, initially?
Yeah. I mean, it's true, too, when you hear a poem, it's a little tough because it's coming at you kind of fast. And also, poems are funny because they put you in this state of associating and dreaming and going into an internal world. And sometimes I think the better the poem is, the more likely you are to lose track of it as you're listening to it. But great, luckily we have this good old technology of the book and can go back to look at things again.
One of the first poems I think I encountered as a high school student was Kubla Khan by Coleridge. And I think about, I mean, it is an alternative state. It is. I mean, you're going into a different state of consciousness when you're reading great poetry.
I recently read this legend of the man from Porlock, I guess, who supposedly interrupted Coleridge, you know, and the poem sort of ends in the middle, and the legend is this guy came to...
That's the apocryphal story. Yeah.
Apparently it's not true. I'm so disappointed to hear that. I think I'm just going to keep believing it's true.
And then you wonder about whether he was using something at the time, some substance at the time.
I think we're pretty sure he was using something, but, you know... Whatever it takes.
I like to tell the story. Probably one of my favorite poets is William Butler Yeats, by far. And I like to tell the story to students that I actually was, sorry to say, I did inhale and all that, like Bill Clinton saying he didn't. I did with cannabis as a young man.
It's all becoming clear to me now.
Yeah, it all right. And I remember writing a poem under the influence and waking up in the morning and writing the poem and thinking, this is as good as anything Yeats has ever written. I woke up in the morning and it was total gibberish. It made absolutely no sense. You know, it's a story that always gets a laugh.
That's true. That's a lesson most poets learn is that the enthusiasm created by the alternate substance is maybe not doesn't last when you reread it.
And there's also this mystique, though. It goes back to Baudelaire and all these other poets. Mm. You know, the more you drink and the more substances, Malcolm Lowry, even Raymond Carver, you know, you're going to drink and you're going to take substances and you're going to write great poetry or great fiction.
He eventually had to quit, though, Carver. And, Baudelaire, always be drunk, he
exactly.
says.
Exactly. You know, that was his line.
But the great thing about that poem is he goes on it, you know, of course, wine, on wine, but on everything. He says on everything, so you don't even need that. Yeah.
Here's Michael who writes, it seems inevitable that you're going to spend this time talking about how people connect to poetry and never talk about the controversy of Bob Dylan's poetry being recognized with the Nobel Prize and how sung poetry as the inheritance of Homer is part of the conversation.
Why would it be inevitable? I mean, now here we are talking about it. I guess it wasn't inevitable. I'm a huge Dylan fan, and I was thrilled that he won the Nobel Prize.
I'm a huge Dylan fan, but I was not thrilled, and I'll tell you
really?
Why.
Oh,
no, in
like
fact,
it.
They had me on television talking about it, and they cut it very short. And then I think they talked to you.
I talked
to somebody from St. Mary's who was going on in these hosannas.
Could have
about
been Brenda, because she's a big Brenda Hillman.
No, it was a man. Brenda's a friend. I would have recognized her in front of the camera. But no, there was this moment where I just said to myself, this has always been novelists who've won the Nobel. Mm. It was kind of maybe a little bit rigid in me in some ways. I thought, why is it a troubadour poet? You know?
Yeah, I mean, it was a little confusing because, of course, it's not the Nobel Prize in poetry. It's a Nobel Prize in literature. And to me, songwriting seems inarguably literature. But they did say in the citation they talked about him as a poet. So it is a little confusing. And I think, strictly speaking, songwriting doesn't need to be poetry in order to be literature, you know. But be that as it may, I was just happy because I think I love him and I just was pretty thrilled about it.
Some people who are loving your poetry. So read us one more, if you would, and then we'll go to our
callers. I'll read you a newer poem. So Amtrak, our national train company, has a magazine every month that they put in all the backs of all the seats, and they've started asking poets to write poems each month. And Juan Felipe Herrera wrote one, and Billy Collins. And so anyway, they asked me to do this, and so I wrote this poem, and I was thinking about that moment when everybody gets on the train and how suddenly we find ourselves all together in this kind of secular yet somehow holy moment of being about to journey together with.
You've already been labeled as a poet of transportation.
Yeah, well, I spent a lot of time on the. Yeah. I'm revealing myself as someone who travels too much. So this poem is called "Poem for Passengers." Like all strangers who temporarily find themselves moving in the same direction, we look out the window without really seeing, or down at our phones trying to catch the dying signal. Then the famous lonesome whistle so many singers have sung about blows, and our bodies shudder. Soon we will pick up speed and pass the abandoned factories there's lately been so much conversation about. Through broken windows they stare, asking us to decide. But we fall asleep next to each other, riding into the tunnel, sharing without knowing the same dream. In it, we're carrying something, an empty casket, somehow so heavy, only together can we carry it over a bridge in the snow. Emerging suddenly into the light, we wake and open our laptops, or a book about murder, or a glossy magazine. Though we're mostly awake, part of us still goes on solving problems so great they cannot be named. Even once we have reached our destination and disembark into whatever weather, for a long time, there is a compartment within us filled with analog silence. Inside us, the dream goes on and on.
Oh, boy. And well read. Thank you for that.
Thanks.
Makes me think of Frost for some reason.
Yeah, Frost. Oh, really? What, I wonder why.
We can talk about that after we're off. In the meantime, let me go to some callers here. And let's start with Anne. Anne, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I called because I was inspired by Barbara Frost, a friend who I really looked up to when I first immigrated to the United States. I barely spoke English, and she read me A Peck of Gold, and it created such a connection.
Speaking of Frost, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
So you were inspired by it. Or she was inspired by it, A Peck of Gold. Well, thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Let me get another caller on here, and that's Diana. Diana, welcome.
Thank you. So I wanted to quickly share a very short poem, and I love how tight it is. It's by Roger McGough, and it goes, "Your finger, sadly, has a familiar ring about it." And then very quickly, if I may, I have a 14-year-old niece, and I would love both of your recommendations. She's just starting to study poetry in high school, so go on. What's the poem that she should read that will make her a devotee for life?
Ooh,
the poem. There's a challenge there. You want to take it, Matthew?
Well, you know, there have been many 14-year-old girls over the years who have really fallen in love with Sylvia Plath, And she gets a bad rap because she sort of, you know.
There's danger there.
Yeah, but she's an amazingly, she has an amazing facility with language and the image and her, and it's so strong. And also her work is far more hopeful than it's discussed. And actually her original ordering of the book Ariel ends on a much more hopeful note. So I would say read Sylvia Plath's bee poems. B-E-E as in the animal.
And thank you for that call. I was actually thinking of Emily Dickinson.
Mm.
But let me go to another caller.
That's
Tom.
A good recommendation, too.
Hi, Tom. You're on.
Hi. When I was an undergraduate at San Francisco State, there was a master poet teaching there, John Logan.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I just think, well, Logan was, and to this day I feel, a neglected and brilliant poet. And he read beautifully. Everybody else, all kinds of poets, well-known poets and student poets and so on, I couldn't listen to it. It was just impossible. We shared a house, and he used to read up in the attic, and everybody would come. And the lyric poets were very important to me. They kind of kept my head together.
It sounds like Logan spoiled you.
Yeah, that's a pretty good. That's a pretty good deal to live in the same house as him.
Yeah, he had a student, John Logan had a student, Joseph Stroud, and he was one of our roommates. We were all together. He had his apartment, and we were in the front. My wife and I were in the front. And they all from the Poetry Center, from the Poetry Department at State, they'd all gather in the house, and they did this. This was the early 60s.
Well, thank you for those reminiscences.
Yes, thank
it's
you.
Good to hear from you. And we'll hear from some more in just a moment. But you seem to be sort of in favor of the whole idea of genres and a little bit uncomfortable with how genres have become so, I'll dare to use the word, colluded or have become so mixed and hybridized and all that.
Well, I don't. It's not that I object in any way to that. Not that it would matter if I objected to it. But no, I love people who cross genres of all kinds. I mean, Maggie Nelson is a good friend, and her works are known for doing that. My point in the book is more that I think the concept of genre can be helpful when trying to sort through confusions in literature, and particularly with poetry. I think it helps because genre is really about purpose, why things and why they're made the way they are and what they're designed to do. So to be a little bit defined about the genre of poetry for a while is a good way to clarify some things. And then, of course, to let it go because it's an artificial division, of course.
Well, what about subgenre? I think I told you a story briefly about Garrison Keillor being on the air and talking about how much he hated the subgenre of confessional poetry, since you mentioned Sylvia Plath. I was about to teach confessional poetry that day.
Yeah, I mean, for me, as I've gotten older, I think those subcategories seem less and less applicable, and they're more. Sometimes they seem more about social groups. You know, we talk about the New York School of Poets. They're actually poets like John Ashbery or Frank O'Hara. They have certain commonalities, but they're actually quite different in the way they write. But they were more just like a group of friends who are, and so those are the in a way those categories can tell us a lot more about how people lived and when they lived than about their actual poems.
Always appreciate my audience, even sometimes when it falls into a kind of quasi-pedantry, but this is a caller named Bob who's absolutely right. He says, just wanted to mention that April is the cruelest month is not the first line of The Wasteland. It is line 51 in the facsimile edition. The first 50 lines have a big red X through them and an arrow pointing to April is the cruelest month with the word start here, done by Ezra Pound.
Right. Ezra Pound edited that it's so in the published version of the final version, it's the first lines. But you know what's great about that is that Pound did edit The Wasteland, and the original title of The Wasteland was "He Do the Police in Different Voices."
Yes.
And it's funny to imagine what the history of English language poetry would be like if that had been the title.
Well, it's dedicated to Ezra Pound in Italian. You know, what does he call my?
He said the better maker.
Yeah, the better maker. Exactly.
Emilio Fabrio.
And here's Julie. Julie, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to say, for me, hearing poetry to a background soundtrack of some sort and hearing it out loud makes just a tremendous difference It makes it so much more enjoyable, and just hearing, you know, the sentence and the tonal shift really helps me to understand it. And I wanted to just give a big shout out to a poet, Kate Tempest. She has a long form poem called Brand New Ancient that is done to music, and she performs it, and it's just wonderful. I really love it. And she got me really back into poetry.
Well, I thank you for the call, and I know she probably thanks you for the shout out. Appreciate hearing from you, and we'll hear from Bill next. Bill, you're on.
Hi. I wanted to thank Matthew for the Statue of Liberty poem that he did in the Guardian, contributed to the Guardian recently. I first found out about his work from Jane Hirschfield at a Litquick thing that they did together years ago. And both his poem and hers in that Guardian piece were quite wonderful. I really liked his reference to the Native Americans.
Well, Jane has been on the program a couple of times. Like I said, we breed good poets out here.
Yeah.
Matthew?
Jane's absolutely, this is a great place. And Jane is fantastic. And I just taught with her up at the Napa Valley Writers Conference, and she's a marvelous poet and teacher. The caller's referring to after this recent kerfuffle over the Statue of Liberty, you know, where that press conference was given, where the guy was talking about how the poem was added later, the Emma Lazarus poem was added later. The Guardian, that magazine, asked a bunch of poets to write sort of responses or rewritings of the Emma Lazarus poem. And so there's a online, there's a number of poets who wrote, you know.
Well, there is something inimitable about "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses,
a great poem.
Longing to be free." Yeah.
Well, and also just to imagine that would be the first thing that so many people saw, whether or not they could read it. I mean, that they would go buy it in those big letters.
There's Molly who writes, "When I was very young, my mother, who died when I was 9, would recite poems to us in the car. Not necessarily highfalutin stuff. I remember the Charge of the Light Brigade, but I loved listening to her. And while I remember the hunt in high school for the deep inner meaning, my access to poetry was through memorizing, and more importantly, reciting. Really makes one commit to what the poem is saying." And Linda writes, "I disliked poetry after too much exposure to the transcendental poets by a high school teacher until I heard the actor Anthony Zerbe give a dramatic recital of the poems of E.E. Cummings. Poetry is meant to be heard, not read."
Yeah, well, people keep coming back to this, and I think it's a great point. In the book, I quote this letter from Robert Frost where he talks about the sound, the way that sound itself carries meaning, you know, in addition to the actual meaning of the words. And I think that people keep coming back to the bodily experience of either hearing a poem or you know, memorizing a poem or just feeling it in themselves and the pleasure and meaning in itself. I mean, Frost says that kind of getting the idea of what the meaning that the sound itself communicates in a poem, it's like hearing voices from behind a door without knowing what they're saying. And all the information you can get from that, we're such experts in language. We're so attuned to it that there's all this knowledge that we get from it, just from the way it sounds and the way it's spoken.
I got an image of eavesdropping.
Yeah,
I mean, it is a kind of eavesdropping, really.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to think about listening to poems in a way.
And we'll listen to some more of our callers. We go next to Sebastopol. Catherine, you're on the air.
I'm so grateful you're doing this program, among other things, and it isn't just that I don't have to wash the kitchen floor right now. I can sit here and talk to you instead. That in my senior year in college, I was exposed to too many new criticism types, and I thought of it as dissecting my own cat. But what I did to save myself was I read Yeats. And I read Yeats, and then that blue book, and then I put the Ferlinghetti poem. I wrote it out by hand in the back about reading Yeats. I do not think of Arcady, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I did Gary Snyder's bibliography for the Phoenix Bookshop, and so I got to read his poems and do all that other stuff. And I had forgotten how much I love poetry. And how important it is to me. And also,
well, you're going to have to get back to washing the floor, though, after we're done.
I know.
At the end of the hour, though.
And I had a job where I got paid to write poetry. I worked for a record company, and I listened to music all day long and then wrote liner notes and artist biographies and stuff like that. So thank you. I had forgotten how much I love poetry.
Well, thank you for letting us know about what you forgot, and we hope we revivified that. And Carol writes, one of my favorite poets is Billy Collins, very approachable, the opposite of intimidating. His topics often mundane, however quite funny and acutely observant and surprisingly tender. And Billy Collins has also, I'm pleased to say, been a guest on Forum. And I mention this largely because the interviews are in the archives. Likewise, Gary Snyder has been on a couple times, and Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
And you know, Ryan has a great – I remember the last time she was on here was fantastic. Her interview with you was
– Well, I'm also reminded of the fact that one of the first – my brother had a copy of Coney Island of the Mind. Mm-hmm. It was one of the first collections of poetry I was exposed to. Mm-hmm. And – you know, it had a kind of electrifying effect on me as a boy. I was just a kid, but
for sure,
it was something about, you know, the language, really, but also what has been perhaps overly and inflatedly described as the beat feeling, or, you know, what the beat movement became. Here's Jenny, who is a prison librarian, and says, my two favorite poems are Parachutes My Love Could Take Us Lighter by Barbara
Could
Guest.
Carry Us Higher, yeah, by Barbara Guest.
Carry Us Higher, I'm sorry, she says Take Us Higher. Yeah. And Barbara Guest and Peanut Butter by Eileen Miles. Mm-hmm. Both are love poems and mimic the waves of falling in and out of love through their style and through their imagery. Both acknowledge the unknown and the ambiguous through their style and their imagery. Miles' poem begins, I am always hungry and wanting to have sex. I adore this line because every time I read it, I feel my past, my present, and my future.
Oh, that's great. And I love both those poets. Barbara Guest, what lived in Berkeley for a long time and is a sort of a spirit parent to many, many, many Bay Area poets. And Eileen Miles is one of our great American poets. And earlier, a person called in and asked about her daughter reading poetry, and I recommended Plath, but maybe I should have recommended Eileen Miles instead.
And we'll bring another caller on. Bonnie, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hundreds of girls in Florida in the 50s and 60s grew up in the summer for a week of camp listening to God's Trombones by a Campfire by James Weldon Johnson's poems. And there's a James Weldon Johnson school in Jacksonville, Florida. And he is a very famous poet, I hope.
Well, he wrote the lyrics to the so-called, I mean, it's not so-called, it was called the Negro National Anthem. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and his poetry was incredible and was so memorable to all the girls. Girls would come for a week at a time, and this was for 8 weeks. A different group would listen to that. So he had an effect on a number of girls by a wonderful camp director called Elizabeth Province and Jerry Baldwin, who sent the ball of fire down when God sent light into the world.
Thank you, Bonnie, for those memories.
Thank you.
I appreciate hearing from you. Good to hear from you. And let me read a comment from a listener who says, what are your thoughts on Shakespeare's sonnets? Why the Dark Lady? Who is the Dark Lady? I like to imagine the Dark Lady as being indiscernible to the active mind, yet always present in the mind of man.
Oh, I like that definition. That works for me. What do I think of his sonnets? They're one of the great performances in language ever.
And what about the sonnet as a form, or for that matter, some of the other forms that are even more becoming more obscure? I mean, think about a villanelle. Or
I love forms. I mean, I write about this in the book, but for when I was first starting to write poetry, when I was at Berkeley, I got the Norton Anthology of Poetry, and in the back it has that little versification section, and with the list of all the forms. I tried to write all the forms, and I wrote really, really terrible poems for a year. But it was great training, and I love reading poems in forms. It's just not really my thing, but it's great. I mean, I love them.
And we go to another caller, and that's you, Reed. You're on. Morning.
Hi. Almost 60 years ago, as an undergraduate at Stanford, I was advised to go in and hear some lectures by Ivar Winters. Winters was the teacher of, I think, Haas or Pinsky or maybe both, and later Tom Gunn. And I was amazed about 10 years ago to come across a commentary by Adam Kirsch, mostly about contemporary poets. But among those essays was an essay on Winters, who, even when I discovered him, was deeply unfashionable. Have you ever read Winters?
I think we've both read Winters. Yeah, I know. Sure. I know Matthew has, and he was mainly known as a literary lion of criticism and so forth. But he was really a fine poet.
I love reading all that criticism, and even if sometimes things go off the rails a little bit or get extreme. I mean, I adore the clear thinking of these of these people. I mean, so I love reading Winters.
And I thank you for the call. Let's get Robert on here while we have a few moments. Robert, go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering your opinion of wonderful San Francisco poet who was just alluded to, Tom Gunn, and another great California poet, no longer with us, sadly, the Fresno poet.
And an unsung poet. I mean, you know, certainly one of the most important voices during the AIDS epidemic was Tom Gunn. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And some thoughts from you?
Well, you were saying, were you going to say the Fresno poet, were you going to say Larry Levis, or were you?
No, not Larry Levis. Well, Larry Levis's mentor, Phil Levine.
Also a terrific poet, working class
Tom
hero.
Gunn was at Cal when I was there, although I never took a class with him, but I love The Man with Night Sweats and other poems. I mean, he was so cool. He walked around this leather jacket, and he was like really dramatic-looking guy, you know.
Let me thank you for that. This has been a splendid hour. I'm looking at a comment from Scott who says, I like to think of poetry as the style of language most able to fly by the limbic system and with any luck allowing us to feel something new and fresh.
That's great.
And that... it's been a great hour, Matthew. Thank you so much
for being
with us. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And again, Why Poetry is the book that is out and available by Matthew Zapruder, but please avail yourself of his poetry as well. And I remind you that you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Our program is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producers are Amanda Stupai and Devin Holt, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Anna Sterla and Patrick Fitzgerald, and our managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. Our executive producer is Holly Kernan. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.